Okay. Welcome to the Ibn Ezra Parshios Matos Matzei. The beginning of Parshios Matos speaks about the whole concept of nedarim, of vows that a person would take upon himself. And the Torah opens up its discussion of vows with a very unusual terminology, phraseology, by Daber Moshe El Roshe Hamatos L'Vnei Yisrael Reimar Zav Dover Shetiva Hashem. Moshe spoke to the heads of the tribes. Very, very unusual. I mean, everything that Moshe Rabbeinu said was conveyed first to the heads of the tribes and then to the rest of the tribes themselves. Why single out this parsha of Nedarim, this parsha that talks about vows, as being communicated to the Roshe Hamatos? It's very fascinating. Ibn Ezra over here, which we'll talk about a little bit and we'll expand upon, just to see how he sees the beginning of Parshas Matos in a somewhat unusual light. Like Ibn Ezra, Lefi Daiti, in my opinion, the very beginning of Parshas Matos, it seems to me that this parasha of the Nedarim was taught to Moshe Rabbeinu, and Moshe Rabbeinu in turn taught it to the Roshei Hamatos, to the Nesi'im, to the princes of the tribes, after the war against Midian, which is described later on in the parasha. In other words, even though the parasha first introduces the discussion about vows, and only afterwards describes the war against Midian, in point of fact, chronologically, they were reversed. The war against Midian happened first, and then the parasha of the vows later on. Came he achareho, kamo v'atadavir Miriam v'Aaron b'Moshe, achar v'ayu b'chatzeros. It says that Ibn Ezra, we sometimes find that events that happen in close juxtaposition to one another can be presented in the Torah in reverse order because they happened around the same time. So the fact that they happened around the same time, it's not so important for the Torah to present things in exact chronological order. They can be presented in approximate chronological order. We know, by the way, that this is a shita, an opinion that the Ibn Ezra has in general, that the Ibn Ezra is much more ready to employ the Gemara's dictum of Ein Mukhtam U'Mukhtam Basara, meaning that the stories as laws that are presented in the Torah are not necessarily in chronological order. As we saw the Rambam, at the Ibn Ezra, beginning of Parshas Korach, says that the rebellion of Korach took place immediately after the story of the Egel Azov, of the golden calf. So we saw over there the Rambam took issue with that. The Rambam says, no, Torah is mostly in order, with a few exceptions. Ibn Ezra is much more comfortable saying, to a large extent, the Torah is not in chronological order. There are many, many more times where the Torah presents things out of chronological order. This is one of them. Va'akosuv Omer, Shebamu b'nei God el Moshe v'el Elazar v'el Nesiei ha'edo v'divru divrehem, v'achat shem kosuv v'yitzav v'hem Moshe v'el Elazar ha'koin v'es Yeshua v'dinom, Yes, Roshe Avos Hamatos, Haim Nisiei Ha'edar Niskarim. Says the Ibn Ezra, this whole parsha of the vows actually ties in with the story which is described at the end of Parshas Matos, how the members of the tribes of God and Reuven are desirous of taking their inheritance in Eretz Yisrael now, in Israel proper, but rather the Eva HaYarden, the portion of Eretz Yisrael, which is on the eastern side of the Jordan River, how they come to Moshe Rabbeinu and they request that portion to be theirs. And Moshe Rabbeinu basically says, look, if you promise that you're going to participate with us when we go in and conquer Eretz Yisrael, in other words, this is not an exemption from battle. You're going to come in with us, Eretz Yisrael. Not only that, you're going to go first. We're saying Al Hashem. You're going to go at the head of the lines to go fight the battles of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and you'll only go back after the wars have been won and the Jewish people have been settled. If you make that solemn promise, then and only then am I willing to give you this land on the eastern side of the Jordan River. It shouldn't be an excuse for you to shirk your responsibilities to the rest of Klal Yisrael. The Torah tells us later on in the Parsha that when Moshe Rabbeinu was having that discussion with the Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven, with the members of those tribes, it says that he told them, he made them promise in the presence of Elazar, the Kohen Gadol, Yehoshua, who's going to be Moshe's successor, and the Roshe Avot HaMatos. He made them promise in the presence of the heads of the other Shvatim, of the other tribes. So it says that Ibn Ezra, just to answer one of our questions, why does Parshas Matos open up with a reference to Moshe Rabbeinu speaking to the Roshe HaMatos, to the heads of the tribes? Because it's those heads of tribes who were present when Moshe Rabbeinu told the Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven that they would have to be committed to be part of the war of conquest before they'd be able to return to the portion which they wanted to make theirs. So what's Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven got to do with the Parsha of the house? Uva'avur sh'omer Moshe Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven. Hayotzei mipichem ta'asu. Since Moshe Rabbeinu told the Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven what you promised, you've got to keep. Hayotzei mipichem ta'asu. Hakein kosu v'yadav Moshe Roshei Hamatos. V'shom kosu k'chol hayotzei mipichem ta'asu. What is this whole Parsha of vows? The theme of the Parsha of vows is what you vow, you've got to keep. So in other words, the whole Parsha of vows is the reaction to the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu, in the presence of the heads of the various tribes, makes the Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven swear that they're going to uphold their promise. And then in the aftermath of that, Moshe Rabbeinu turns around, again, in the presence of the elders, you know, who were involved in the situation up to, you know, right up until that point, Moshe Rabbeinu turns around and says, by the way, this idea that if you vow, you have to keep your promise, that's not unique to the Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven. It's not some like idea I just came up with, by the way, you know, we're going to penalize you, whatever you say you've got to do. This is the fundamental aspect of Judaism. There's a whole area of halacha called Hilchos Nedarim, that if you promise you're going to do something, you've got to do it. So in other words, the beginning of Parshas Matos, the whole description of Nedarim, of vows, and their value, is immediately tied to the end of Parshas Matos. It's the result of what's put forward over there, the idea that the Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven had to stay steadfast to their words, and whatever they pledged to do was something that they had to do in actuality. It's a very interesting juxtaposition. And I just want to raise the following point, and we'll talk about it after Magnus. Chazal generally understand that the Nidzarim that are described in the beginning of Parshas Matos were what are called Nidrei Issa. That's when you prohibit something upon yourself. Right? In other words, a person wants to give up smoking, which is a good thing. So he says, I hereby label cigarettes to be off limits to me, and I want to label them as a prohibited substance. That's Nidrei Issa, that I vowed in such a way to label something as prohibited, and therefore I can't use it. It's clear that within the Ibn Ezra's approach, the main idea of the Parsha of Nedarim is not to label something as being offer, but rather a neder in the sense of a pledge, where a person is making a commitment to do something. What you pledge to do, you have an obligation to follow through on. Well, we pick up after Magnus, as we'll talk a little bit more about that distinction, how Ibn Ezra is putting a slightly different emphasis on the Parsha than do Chazal. I think in the end of the day, the interpretations complement one another rather than contradict one another, but we'll flesh that out a little bit. There's the question after Magnus. Okay, I'm out of Akasha Omer. Welcome to part two of the Shirin Ibn Ezra, Parshas Matos. So in the brief part one, we saw the Ibn Ezra at the beginning of Parshas Matos, where he raises the question raised by all the Rishonim, you know, why the unusual terminology Roshei HaMatos, by Dabi Moshe, Roshei HaMatos, that Moshe spoke to the heads of the tribes. You know, it's very unusual for the Torah to use such a phraseology. And what's the Parsha of Nedarim, of vows being introduced over here? So the Ibn Ezra links this Parsha to the story at the end of Parshas Matos, where the Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven give their solemn pledge to Moshe and the Roshi Hamatos, to the heads of the tribes, that they're not going to abandon the rest of the Jewish people. They'll go in with the Jewish people. They'll conquer Eretz Yisrael together with the Jewish people. So how do we know that the whole idea of a pledge is something that a person has to respect? You know, I mean, maybe your word isn't worth all that much, right? How do you know you have to keep your word? So, you know, it's at this point in history that Moshe Rabbeinu introduces the parasha of Nedarim, because right now, really, in the context of the Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuben, it's become very relevant, because for the first time, a group is giving a pledge about what they plan on doing, and the Torah is putting forth the idea that what comes out of your mouth, you know, binds you as much as God's commandments bind you as well. It's interesting, you know, we pointed out that the Ibn Ezra is very, plays fast and loose a little bit with chronology in the Torah. It doesn't bother the Ibn Ezra that really chronologically this parasha of the Nedarim really belongs, you know, at the end of the parasha, right? It should have been introduced at the end of the parasha when the Torah is telling the story of the Bnei Gad of Bnei Reuben. Okay, so I understand that, you know, the Torah isn't hung up on chronology, but why would the Torah deliberately put things out of order? It's one thing to say that it doesn't matter, you know, whether things are in order or not, but you would think, all things being equal, you might as well put things in chronological order, right? So why would the Torah put the parasha of Nedarim first and the story that generated the parasha of Nedarim second? Yeah, right? Like many other parashiyos. I mean, all of Hesed Dvarim wasn't said till the 40th year, right? So, you know, I guess, you know, Ibn Ezra would say that there wasn't really a need for the parasha of Nedarim, so the Bnei Gad of Bnei Reuben came along and pledged to do something above and beyond, you know, what was wrong. No, I guess they didn't really have a, you know, in other words, I guess it wasn't relevant, and they weren't making the Nedarim, you know, left and right. Maybe, could be, right? So, but I guess it wasn't relevant, as everyone understands. It's just, it didn't come up. I mean, how often does it come up for us? You know, I mean, okay, a person does something three times, he doesn't say Bnei, okay, but I mean, how many Nedarim does the average Jew make on a regular basis? So, but why, you know, why deliberately have it out of order? I mean, it seems like a little bit odd. I think the answer to the question is, although chronologically the parashiyos is out of order, conceptually they're in order. Because in order for Moshe Rabbeinu's dictum to the Bnei Gad of Bnei Reuben, Hayosim Yitzchem Ta'asu, whatever comes out of your mouth you have to do, in order for that to have any meaning, you know, conceptually it's important for us to first understand that there's a parasha of Nedarim. Right? In other words, that, yeah, in general, whatever you pledge to do, you actually do have to do. So in other words, if you're looking at it in terms of laying out the concepts, it does make sense to first learn the concept of Nedarim, and then to see the application of Nedarim, you know, in a particular context, even though chronologically the story happens first, and that gave rise to Moshe Rabbeinu needing to share these halachos with Klal Yisrael. Comes afterwards, right. I guess I don't know. In other words, I see it's not this fact. It's a good point. In other words, by Rabbi Navi assuming that their punishment was because they were shtuya yayin, so the parsha of shtuya yayin only comes afterwards. It could be again. We're talking within the Ibn Ezra. I'm not sure that the Ibn Ezra, you know, necessarily identifies the sin of Nadav and Aviv as being, you know, related to the fact that they drank wine, in which case, you know, that kasha falls away because those kashas are not necessarily linked, you know, from his perspective. So, we mentioned something very briefly at the end of part one of the shiur, which I want to explore a little bit more. Chazal typically understands that the whole parasha of the Nedarim is primarily dealing with Nidrei Issa, where I vow to make something off limits to me. Whereas it's clear that the Ibn Ezra sees at least part of the parasha of the Nedarim as what we call nidrei mitzvah, you know, where a person vows that he's going to do something which is a positive thing, a mitzvah. In other words, the Bnei Gad of Bnei Reuben were pledging to commit themselves to something. They weren't saying that an object is prohibited to me. You know, they were pledging to do something very, very positive. Where do you see that in the psukim themselves? So it's interesting. There is an Ezra and Pasuk Gimel. Right, Pasuk Gimel here says, "Ish ki yidor neder l'Hashem." When a person swears a vow to Hashem, or he takes an oath to prohibit something upon himself, he should not desecrate his words. Again, the Ezra points out that terminology is exactly the same terminology that was addressed to the Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven. What comes out of your mouth, you should do, again, which enables the Bnei Ezra to link the parashiyos together. What does it mean, ki yidor neder l'Hashem? A person makes an oath to Hashem. Right? So, one way to understand it is that the person invokes God's name while making the neder. Right? There's a whole discussion in Rishonim. Is it necessary for a shvuah, for an oath, to contain God's name in order for it to be a valid oath? So that goes back to the question. But Ibn Ezra has a somewhat different understanding. He first says, Hashem, Shehizkir Hashem, right? In other words, he does mention the idea that the vow to Hashem means explicitly mentioning the name of God. However, he then says, V'haneder, what is the content of the vow that he takes? In Yiyya Kain, Eten l'shem kach b'kach. The first kind of a vow is a pledge, right? In other words, if I experience a refuah, so I'm going to give money to shul, money to the Beit HaMikdash, whatever it happens to be, right? The person makes a pledge. O es aneh. Or I will fast. In other words, the idea of the neder, one of the quintessential aspects of the neder is pledging to a religious cause or pledging to fast. It seems like where did Ibn Ezra get that from? It seems like from the word Hashem. In other words, Yidor Neder Hashem means, according to Ibn Ezra, not just that you mention God's name, but that you vow to do something religious. You vow to God, you vow to pledge either your money or your person in some way. The person pledges to fast. That's the neder that we're talking about over here. Where do you get the idea of fasting from? It's very unusual. Where should you read that into the pasuk? So the neder, a little bit later on, points out that this is the simple shot in a pasuk a little bit later on over here. Pasuk Yudalit. Kol neder v'chol shvuah isar le'anos nafesh. Any vow or oath that the person takes, le'anos nafesh, to afflict the soul. What's afflicting the soul? Right? Ibn Ezra, who had soul? That refers to fasting. Where do you get the idea that afflicting the soul is fasting? Truth is, afflicted by Yom Kippur. The yisem es nafshel seichem. You should afflict your soul. What does afflicting your soul mean over there, Cass? Right? So it says Ibn Ezra against Trump, Kol neder v'chol shvuah isar le'anos nafesh means that the person has sworn to fast, right? So the Ibn Ezra sees from these kids in the psukim that the primary focus of the parsha of Nedarim is that the person is taking on themselves to do something religious, to fast, to pledge money. In the case of Bnei Gad, Bnei Reuven, to pledge to be a source of support to the rest of the Jewish people, and that's the focus of the parsha of Nedarim. Now, does that mean that the Ibn Ezra sees that as the only role of a neder? After all, as we said before, Chazal, when they talk about Nedarim Sechter Nedarim, see the quintessential form of a neder as being Nedre Ishtar, that a person says that a certain object is offered upon me, prohibited to me. Right? The Chazal, the Gemara, famously describes that a neder is an Ishtar. Right? That's where the terminology comes from, is that you're prohibiting a certain object. Right? So does the Ibn Ezra deny all of that? So we'd be hard pressed to say that the Ibn Ezra denies all of that, because again, the Ibn Ezra told us in the beginning of his commentary
that although he sometimes will take issue with Chazal when it comes to homiletic issues, Midrashim, Akadah, the like, when it comes to Halacha, the Ezra is a straight parish of Al-Kemir. You know, he's not deviating from Chazal one iota. So then how do you square that with the definition of Nidarim? I think one has to say, even though the Ibn Ezra doesn't say it directly, that the Ibn Ezra is just describing what he considers to be the Pshat's quintessential Nidar. In other words, the quintessential Nidar, according to Pshat and Chumash, is Nidrei Mitzvah, where a person, you know, swears that he's going to perform a mitzvah or fast to do something like that. But clearly, the idea of Nidrei Yitzhar is also true. It's just that that's a secondary aspect of the idea of Nidarim according to the Ibn Ezra. I mean, that's the Pshat in Pasuk. Lest our Yitzhar al-Nasha, to make something prohibited upon himself. Right? That presumably means Nidrei Yitzhar, even according to the Ibn Ezra, that he's saying a certain object is also upon the person. I think, although we glean from the Ibn Ezra certain perspectives in the Torah. In other words, what would move a person, what would motivate a person to engage in Nidrei Yitzhar? Why would you go around saying, you know, Konam Zavar Ze Olai, in the words of the Gemara, you know, this object is prohibited to me like a carbon. What would motivate you to do something like that? And I think according to the Ibn Ezra, the answer is, the whole point of any Nidrei Yitzhar is to encourage the person to do a mitzvah. Meaning, let's go back to the example we had before. A person wants to stop smoking. Why does he want to stop smoking? Because he's cognizant of the Torah's dicta, the Mishnah, and the Olam Hashem Seichem. You should guard your health. Smoking is not healthy. Right? So he wants to force himself not to smoke. So in order to reinforce his commitment not to smoke, right, he goes out and he buys 5 packs of chewing gum. And in addition to his 5 packs of chewing gum, he says, "Come on, cigarettes are life." Right? I want to treat cigarettes as totally off limits to me, and I view it, I want to make a nether, a vow, in order to underscore the degree to which I'm squaring off cigarettes. Right? That has a certain utility. In other words, the person is prohibiting an object in order to get him to do the right thing. It's nezer l'Hashem. Right? It's in order to get him to do a mitzvah, something which is positive. To stop go around saying, "Hey, I don't like tomatoes, so call them tomatoes a lie. You know, I'm treating tomatoes as being offered to me." Right? So the Ezra would say, "Look, I mean, that is a nether, you know, but that's not really the quintessential example of a nether, because that's a frivolous nether. It is a nether, but it's a foolish sort of thing to do."
That wife cannot make a nether to answer a mitzvah or a mitzvah.
Well, a nether on a mitzvah actually is chal. A shvua on a mitzvah is not going to be chal, because ain't shvua chal a shvua.
Okay, but
it's chal
that has work with what Ezra is saying. The whole point of
it has
to do with
right. Right. So he says, "Kol masa alai," and it happens to be Leil Pesach. Right. So that's why Enoch Yami. I mean, the truth is, Ibn Ezra would look at that, and you know, Ibn Ezra would probably call the guy into his office if he had an office and say, "You know, you shnedrik. You know, like, what did you do?" But the truth is, once the Torah creates the concept of nedarim, they work. You know, and they work even in situations where they're to your spiritual disadvantage. You know, and as once the monster has been created, you know, it kind of takes on a life of its own. But the purpose of Nidarim, I think that's what the Ibn Ezra would say, on a hashkafic level, oftentimes Pshat can teach us something on a hashkafic, on a philosophical level. The Pshat in Nidarim is that Nidarim are meant to spur you on to greater heights of commitment to Hashem, you know, not to just make frivolous things, and certainly not to get in the way of your commitment to Torah mitzvah. Rabbi Yudin raised before the interesting point. Let's say that the parasha of Nidarim was only introduced at this point in time. It certainly sounds like Ibn Ezra is saying it. It sounds like the Chumash is saying that, right? You know, otherwise the Chumash is just sort of arbitrarily putting it over here in the end of Sefer Bamidbar. So what happened to all of those years that the Jews were in the desert? They weren't making Nidarim? So perhaps according to Ibn Ezra we can say, yeah. Because the whole point of Nidarim was to motivate you sort of artificially, to give you the extra boost, you know, to do that which is right, to be good at the God's mitzvahs. The generation that was in the Midbar, that was getting mum, that was drinking from the Be'er, that was surrounded by the Amar Yaakov, they didn't need any extra incentive. Oh, by the way, you know, if you're good, well, we'll get you a lollipop, right? No, they didn't need any extra incentive to grow closer to our Kodesh Baruch Hu. They were at the pinnacle of closeness. They didn't need Nadar. But now we're at the tail end of the 40 years in the desert. Now we're having a generation which is going to have a more mundane type of existence. Perhaps they, more than others, need Nadarim in order to push them in the right direction and, you know, to give them another vehicle to sort of self-motivate themselves to come closer to our Kodesh Baruch Hu. Perhaps, you know, that's why the Parsha of Nadarim is after introduced over here, because it finds its utility that's at the very end of the period of the Jewish people being in the Midbar.
Right,
right, right. And so it happens to come to the fore with the Negar of Bnei Ruvein, who now all of a sudden have to make this pledge. But the truth is, it's not just them, it's the whole, you know, the life of the people now is going to change, where having a little bit of extra incentive to do what's right is only going to be a good thing. Okay? Bezos Hashem, next week we will be back on Wednesday. I hope to be here between Mincha and Iris, and we'll see everybody then.